making paper.
Welcome to episode 73 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Mindell Dubansky, who is head of the Sherman Fairchild Center for Book Conservation at the Watson Library in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she is a preservation librarian and book conservator. She writes on the book arts, particularly in the areas of 19th century publishers' bindings, hand papermaking, book binding, the history of book-shaped objects, and American decorative paper arts. In 2016, Dubansky had the first exhibition of her personal collection of 250 book-shaped objects at the Grolier Club in New York City. She is currently working on another Grolier Club exhibition to open in January 2023 about American decorative paper art from the 1960s through 2010, based on the Paper Legacy Project and collection that she recently created for the Watson Library. Dubansky holds a BFA in Drawing and Printmaking from Carnegie Mellon University, an MLS and Certificate in Library Preservation from Columbia University, and has studied bookbinding and restoration at the Camberwell College of Arts in London. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Mindell Dubansky, welcome to Paper Talk.
Hi, Helen.
It's fun to talk with you. And tell me a little bit about where you grew up, went to college, and how you got into books, paper, conservation.
Okay, we can, of course, spend the entire hour on that. But we will try to do, because, you know, if for people who do what I do, especially if they're the age that I'm at, which is my late 60s, 67, it's a circuitous route. Mm-hmm. There was no straight line. Other than, if you're asking me about my childhood, there probably was a straight line to being an artist from that point. When I was, you know, I had creative parents. They were not artists, but they constantly were making things and they fixed things. Mm-hmm. So, and they invented things, you know, as a lot of people did in the 50s. These people knew, you know, if you wanted something, you had to make it, right? You couldn't go out and buy everything. This is like a pre-plastic age. And so I don't know if, you know, the younger people really understand how different it was in terms of that kind of like making things was so normal for people. So I learned a lot from my parents. My mother was an amazing tailor and seamstress. My father was did construction, and he just made stuff and liked to fix old furniture. And my mother, I guess I must have been artistic when I was little without really realizing it, because my mother did send me to Mary's art studio as early as elementary school. I had formal art classes as well as other kinds of classes. My mother was worked full time. She was a sales lady in clothing shops. When I was little, she was in a bridal shop, which was extremely creative in terms of material and fabrics. So I learned to paint at Mary's Art Studio and do pastels. Mostly I remember doing pastels on velour paper.
Oh, yeah.
That was a big, still lives. And then painting landscapes, but just always painting and making, you know, making things. You brought a lot to mind. By the time I got to, I would say high school, I had a great opportunity because there was a special course. I know Susan Scher mentioned something like this in her interview with you, whereas there was a special art program that I had to apply to and interview, you know, sort of compete for. Mm-hmm. And it was three periods of art a day. So basically I had art classes all day by the time I was a junior in high school. And so I had a lot of opportunity, and I was the youngest in that class. And so I even learned more because there were kids that were much more, you know, the seniors were much more advanced by me than I was. And I had I've been really lucky in my life to have some important mentors when I needed them. And that was a stressful time because it was right in the middle of the civil rights movement. There was a lot of stress. I lived in Baltimore City. And I had an amazing art teacher, Miss Hill, when I was a senior, Rita Hill, who was a witch. She was a white witch. She wore garlic around her neck. And she was very exotic and beautiful and interesting. And she used to give me the eye, and she would stare at me and she'd say, you know, I think you could do this. And then she would sort of set some amazing challenge for me that I just thought was impossible for me to do. But somehow I always did it. So that gave me a lot of confidence until, of course, I set fire to the art room with my still life that I felt like I had to light the candle under the dried plants. That was a little setback. But but in general, I did win the art every year. Each subject in school, you know, at the end of the year, one person got an award in each subject. And when I graduated, I did get the art award, which I also had completely forgotten about. Which gave me a senatorial scholarship to free tuition anywhere in Maryland if I wanted to go there, but I wanted to get the hell out of Dodge. So also, you know, there someone from Carnegie Mellon showed up at school and said, you know, if you want to go to Carnegie Mellon and they want you, you'll get a scholarship. And they had a really good art program. So I applied there. I don't think my parents knew what the heck was going on. I just like did it all myself. And next thing I knew, I got accepted to Carnegie Mellon. I got a tuition scholarship that year, full tuition that first year, and told my father to load up the truck. We're going to Pittsburgh. So that's what happened. So I went to Carnegie Mellon. My degree was in drawing and printmaking.
Okay.
So there was an art bookbinder. There's a famous library at Carnegie Mellon called the Hunt Botanical Library. And in that library was a British book restorer and fine binder, Jean Gunner. She worked in the library and she did offer classes in hand bookbinding, but I couldn't take them when I was in college because you couldn't take them for credit. And because I was on scholarship, I had a full schedule and I was working. I was working like so many jobs. So I didn't have time and I, you know, to really, but just the minute I graduated, I signed up for that class. So when I was a junior, how I made the switch, how I got intrigued by old books was that I took a junior year abroad and I studied at the Exeter College of Art in England. Mm-hmm. And, when I was in England, I really had exposure to antiquarian books for the first time because they were basically everywhere. And I was just blown away by everything about them, by the texture of the letterpress printing, about the quality of the wood engraving and the interest in the book covers, the 1880s, 70s, 80s, 90s. I just loved them. So I had already done wood engraving. I taught myself wood engraving. So I was really interested in also lithography. So I had a connection to the book. I just didn't really know that they existed.
Right.
So much as till I had that. So when I came back, you know, when I was a senior, that's when I really kind of got focused on like my interest in books and wanting to fix them and learn how to make them. And so that's what happened. And then, of course, how it actually happened was then after I took a couple classes, I asked the teacher, well, where can I go learn to be a bookbinder, which there was basically nowhere. And then someone in my class told me, well, there's this place in New York that had just opened recently, the Center for Book Arts, and maybe I could go there. And so I said, well, I can't just leave Pittsburgh and go to New York with like on the chance that, you know, I'm going to be a bookbinder. So I did sign up for graduate school at Pratt, which lasted about one semester. And then I went to Center for Book Arts with all the books that I had made in my class, you know, and I basically, this is the way I did everything. And it was always a big mistake where once something came into my head, I believed it to be true. So in my mind, this is what happened when I went to England. It's like, I went there and I had all these ideas that things, you know, they were going to be, you know, I can't even go into it. It was really a disaster, but it's a flaw in my personality. So I imagined because I thought I could go to the Center for Book Arts and learn to be a bookbinder, then that was just automatically what was going to happen. And I didn't even have to like call them up on the phone or write them a letter. So I just like showed up with my books under my arm and said, okay, I'm here. Like, where's my table? I'm ready to go. I need to be a bookbinder. How I wound up where I wound up is like sort of a miracle considering, you know, my technique of accomplishing anything. So they looked at me like I was crazy. I saw Richard, and I explained to him how this had to happen. And, you know, I needed to be there. And he's just like laughing at me, of course. And
this is Richard Minsky, who founded the Center for the Arts.
Told me to go away.
When, Like 1978?
Well, this was, I graduated in 76. So for a year, I stayed in Pittsburgh doing a lot of different jobs. Mm-hmm. Very amusing, but I can't go into them now. And then I decided to make this, you know, I had taken bookbinding classes during that year. And that's when I decided, well, okay, this is it. I had been looking. Mm-hmm. I had been looking in my mind for like the career, like how was I going to turn my art into a career? And I was waiting for the thing that was going to be possible for me to do and like mm-hmm. that I thought I could do and wanted to do. So bookbinding, and anybody will tell you, it's Cupid's arrow. You get hit, that's like getting hit over the head with a mallet in a cart, like you're a cartoon character or something, right? And then you have to do. So it was just a matter of figuring out how and where, you know, like how. And so I, now that I knew about this opportunity, it was, that was it, right? So yeah, showed up, and Richard tried to get rid of me, and it didn't work. And then fortunately, one of the they had internship program at that time, paid internships, because this was a moment in American history where, you know, the 70s revival of craft in America, you know, there was a lot of support. So I think it was the Tiffany Foundation was supporting an apprenticeship at the Center for Book Arts for a number of people. And one of the interns had an opportunity, apprentices had an opportunity to go study in Italy with Gabriel Rummins, I think. So of course they were going to leave. And there was suddenly, at the minute I got there, there was this window of opportunity,
right?
You know, magic as always has happened. I've been so lucky in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, and my internship was $67 a week. It was like 4 days a week. And at that time, interns or apprentices worked. Like, we did projects that the center got paid for. Mm-hmm. And in the other time, the rest of the time, we had teachers coming to teach us. Haiti Kyle, Bruce Schnabel came and taught us classes. Richard taught us classes. And then the guest people who came there regularly from all over the world taught us. You know, we could take any workshop. So I had an amazing 4 years there.
It was a 4-year program?
It was a 2-year internship, but I stayed for 4 years and I just kept working. Okay. And as I was there, you know, without realizing it, that changed my life in so many ways, because A, I've got my wonderful career of bookbinding, which I love so much. And I've always it's always given me so much. And the person that like all my boyfriends came from the Center for Book Arts, of course, even John, who I knew for like 30 years.
Yeah.
And who was the first member of the Center for Book Arts. And also my mentors, you know, who were like basically Polly Lada-Mazarski, of course, Richard, Polly Lada-Mazarski and Joan Davidson. So Polly Lada-Mazarski was this magical woman. Did you ever meet her?
No.
Oh my God. Well, for me, she was from another planet, because I'm from working class Baltimore. She was like convent school in Paris in the 20s.
And oh, wow. You know,
like, she was like, her father owned a silk mill. I mean, she must have been, you know, in her 80s when I met her, maybe 70s, late 70s. Her husband had just died. Incredibly elegant, wonderful, special woman with this beautiful sense of fashion and design, sweeping in this crazy black car, this old wonderful car. And she would just, I would just look at her from afar and just like, wow, what an interesting person, different than anyone I had ever met. She would go back and forth because she was on the board. And one day she marches up to me and she said, you know, Mindy, like, I think you need to go to London and you need to study fine binding and restoration. You need to go to Camberwell. And I'm like, what? I'm not going anywhere. Like, this is it. Like, I've got my spot, you know? Uh-huh. And, oh my God. And she worked on me so hard. She nudged me. She called my mother. She raised the money for me to go. She said, how much money do you have? I said, I literally had $8,000 left from like babysitting money and throwing pizza. Like that was my bank account. And she says, all right, I'll get the rest for you. And she raised the money for me to go from Joan Davidson, who had a foundation, and all her girlfriends. So I was getting like letters in the mail with $100 checks saying, oh, have a wonderful time in England, dear. And, you know, be like, I guess I'm going, you know. I was like, not really, it was out of my comfort zone, even though I had lived in England before. I was kind of happy. So that's when I really, I mean, I had a good foundation in handbook binding and box making and book restoration and, you know, everything from the center for 4 years, because I took every single workshop. letterpress printing and all the decorative paper making. I had a lot of that under my belt, but I didn't have the fine binding, the historic book structures, the sort of basic conservation skills, which I did receive when I by going to Camberwell. And she said to me, you'll get any job. Well, part of her sales pitch to me. And like, I don't think in my entire life I had ever listened to anyone before, like let someone just tell me what to do on faith and believe it. She, except for Miss Hill, maybe Polly was like, I just thought, well, I'm just going to have to put my faith in her. If she tells me like she knows what she's doing, you know, I'm going to do it. So that was hard for me because I'm like stubborn. And I'm a Leo. So I did it.
And, how long
she
were you
says,
there?
No, where you get any job you want when you come back.
How long were you at Camberwell?
Just a school year. So it was 10 months.
Okay.
It was a lot. But there I learned amazing things, you know, all the historic binding structures, account books, and like Kelmscott style vellum binding, and all the every century of British bookbinding technology, and leather and fine binding and gold tooling. It was really wonderful. I had a wonderful gold tooling teacher. I wish I could remember anything I learned. Anderson, I'd have to work at it. So when I graduated, I decided, well, I got to go on a little trip because I'm in Europe. Who knows when I'm going to be back? So I went on some wild trip. Who knows where I wound up, in Greece or Italy, and I took the magic bus. I don't know if you remember the magic bus. You're probably too young, but there used to be this like hippie bus that you could get in Europe, you know, and it was cheap.
Yeah.
And I literally fell asleep on the bus when I crossing the channel back to England. After I crossed the channel, I got back on and I opened my eyes and the bus was on my corner in Peckham. Like it was on my street. So I said, could you just let me out here? Yeah. So he did. And I went inside and there was I think my roommate told me that the librarian from the Met I had applied for a job. Kathy Weldon, who had been the executive director of the Center for Books, sent me this job opportunity at the Met. That Nancy Russell, who had that job for 17 years, retired, and they were looking for someone. So I had written the librarian, said, this is my, just like I did when I went to the center, like, okay, hold it for me, because I'm going to travel for a month, and then I'll be back, and I'm ready for the job, you know? And it's like, he laughed at me, of course, and he said, like, well, we're trying to find someone right away, so if it's open when you come back, you know, maybe, but don't count on it, because I'm really wanting to get somebody. So sure enough, I got off the bus, I went into the house, my roommate said, oh, Mr. Walker called, like, he wants you to come for an interview. And I, like, literally went back the next day to New York, and I hadn't given up my apartment, because I didn't know where I was going to be, you know, like, what was going to happen. So I went back. I bought a dress. I didn't have a dress. Everything was jeans, right? I bought a dress. I got my little suitcase like I always did. And I went for my interview the next day. And I wasn't worried about it because Carolyn Horton, who was a freelance book conservator, conservation studio, had offered me a job. So I knew I could work for her. And I went for my interview and I slammed my books on this desk and I said, okay, this is what I can do. You know, I just showed them like those. Not everyone talks in interviews. I just showed people what I could do. So he said, well, I'll call you in 2 weeks. 2 weeks. It's like, that was forever then, right? Like I hadn't had a day without bookbinding like for like 5 years, right? So I was like, I can't wait 2 weeks. No. So I accepted Carolyn Horton's job. And the next day, and I was staying with my friend Laura, thank God, because the next day he called me at Laura's house. Did I already tell you the story a million times?
No.
So he calls me at Laura's. I'm in my friend Laura's house. The phone rings and he says, oh, this is Bill Walker. We'd like to offer you the job. I literally slammed the phone down on him. I just like hung the phone up. And my friend Laura said, who was that? And I said, well, that was the librarian, the Met. She says, what did he want? I said, he offered me the job. She says, call him back. He hung up on him. She wasn't there. I don't know what I would have done. I just, because I had already accepted this other job. And I just thought, like, if you know me, you know that I'm like, I already made this decision. It's over. I did it. Like, it's too, she's, you know, so I called. So I thought, like, well, I can't take this job because I already took this other job.
Right.
So I called up Carolyn Horton and she said, don't worry about it. I'm going to retire this year. I can't offer you health insurance. Like, take the Met job. You're lucky. You know, that's perfect. So that's what I did. And of course, Polly had already called up the librarian to tell him he wasn't offering me enough money and he should offer me more, which he did. So when I got there, he said, like, yeah, I heard, you know, I called your reference. She just basically yelled at me and I went, sounds so, she, you know.
Oh, you keep good company, Mindy. That's
she
good.
Was on it. She was like, I told you this was going to happen, and it happened. So, you know, so
all
that
right.
was what happened.
Okay, so this was in the Thomas
that
Watson
was 80,
Library?
82, I think.
1982, and you're still at the Met today.
Yes, ma'am. Not into change.
Mm-hmm.
And where else am I going to go? Like, what could be better?
I know. Well, that's what I want to talk about, the Met, amazing institution. I want to hear a little bit about what you've done with paper there, but also just the cool institution. So let's start with the kind of work that you do and the things that come across your desk, just in a nutshell.
In a nutshell.
Yeah.
After I got to the Met, I went to Columbia and I got my library degree and advanced degree in preservation administration. Mm-hmm. I already had the hands-on skills and experience. And I created the preservation department because before it was just a little hangout of, you know, this basement storeroom. And we were just like not doing nice things to books because that was the tradition then, you know, just to get them on the shelf. And course, there was a huge awareness of preservation and conservation right around then, and it was the first program in the country. And so I convinced my boss to, think about things differently, expand the staff, renovate the studio a little, and think about preservation and minimal treatments more so than restoration technique. Anything destructive. So over the years, and I was lonely because I was alone when I first went there. So I called everyone I knew, like all my friends. That's how I know Susan Sharon and Paula Burdell. I said, like, will somebody come and keep me company here and be a volunteer and I can, I had a wonderful opportunity. Plus there was so much work to do. The main research, Watson Library is the main research library at the museum. The museum also had over 21 other libraries, which we assisted. And all the books had to be safely on the standing alone on the shelf and be able to be handled and protected. Rare books had to be protected. And there was just many, many daily tasks, much more than any person can do. And so I've been there 38 years. So over 38 years, we've renovated. We have a beautiful lab now. We have a staff of 5 and, 4 full-time, 1 part-time. And we've done, every year we get a grant from New York State to work on the rarest books in the museum and drawings and prints department. And as you know, all my career, I've also tried to educate the museum staff and the public about the book and paper arts. So right from the beginning, I had an exhibition program. Mm-hmm. I've always given tours and gallery talks and published about the book. So I've always done that simultaneously to doing the hands-on work, tried to further the field.
I wanted to ask how is the pipeline for conservation? Like, do you have do you have like rooms full of things that need to be worked on and how is it?
The workflow yes, it's very organized. The most important thing is anything newly acquired is a priority because if it's newly acquired, it needs labeling, it needs boxing, you know, so we have to, anything. And we have a lot of rare books coming in because we have a very active friends department. So anything, special collections get priority, and it's called general processing. Means a lot of things. It could mean repair. It could be conservation treatment. It could just be in stabilization and protection, Mylar wrappers, or you know that kind of thing, or a custom box or a commercial box. It could mean tipping things in that are loose. It can mean all kinds of things. So all those things are the first priority, and any other newly acquired material, because if it's newly acquired, it means it's part of the pipeline for the whole library and there's people waiting for it. So so that's usually a priority. And other than that, we have particular projects that we work on, but we don't just go looking for work in the stacks. That doesn't happen too much. Although there might be a particular project that we realize is a problem, like for instance, the quartos, big heavy books are always kind of falling over. So we have a project that we do whenever we have time of like reassessing the quartos and boxing things that need boxing, because if something's boxed, it helps the other books stand up straight as well.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So stuff like that might be a project. And then, of course, as I said, we have a rare books project and drawings and prints every year. And that's a subject oriented project. So we pick a particular collection. This year, it's anatomy books. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. And you mentioned the stacks, and I wanted
exhibitions too. We're getting increased requests for books, using books for exhibitions all over the world, which we never had so much. There's a general awareness now in museums of including books in art exhibitions.
Yeah.
I noticed a big change in that.
Yeah, right. I want to just describe going to visit you at the Met, because I've visited you there several times, and it's kind of fun to go to the security guard and say, I'm here to see Mindy Dubansky, who works in the Watson Library, and then get a little clip or something, and then walk through
visitor's
and take
pass.
This visitor's pass, and then take the elevator down into the basement. And one time I remember you had something you were doing. So you said, go, just let me take you into the stacks to the paper section, which is far from your office. And you left me there to look around while you were doing something. Mm-hmm. And I found this little, it was like a pamphlet, typewritten journal of Lawrence Barker's when he studied with Douglas Howell way back. I don't know what year that was. I've interviewed Lawrence, by the way, listeners. His podcast is on here. So that was just really a fun discovery, because I had known he had gone to work with Douglas, but I didn't realize that he'd actually written something about it. And
me either.
Yeah. So many treasures. And
that's getting more and more. We have really increased that in the past few years. We have really increased that collection, and it's like a gold mine. I mean, the Watson Library is a gold mine anyway. You never disappoints. I mean, the things we have are phenomenal. That's really an unusual thing, though. A really unusual manuscript, it sounds like.
Yeah, just a small little thing. Right, and tell us a little bit about just the Watson Library as a research library, like who comes
in there? Yes, we are very, very open to visitors. Anybody over 18 can use our library, and it's a very welcoming. I hope it's a welcoming, we want to be welcoming. We feel that we're welcoming. Of course, the Met itself can be a little intimidating for people who aren't used to doing research there. But I especially welcome artists to use the collection, because, it's a great resource for artists as well as scholars and students in art history and in the arts in general. And it's an incomparable collection of materials, art, architecture, and everything that supporting the Met's collection, encyclopedic collection. And in the past 10 years, we have really increased our collections on the book and paper arts through gifts, especially we got an incredible gift from Mary Schlosser. And also through purchase through our friends group, those funds go towards purchasing rare materials. And of course, we'll talk about it later, but the paper legacy collection, which I've been building up. And so everybody, you get it, go online to metmuseum.org or Watson Library. You get a reader's register for a reader's card. You come in, of course, now after we're going to start taking, it's COVID, so people will have to wait a little bit, but we do have very strong online resources as well, digital resources. So if you get a reader's card, you'll have a lot of opportunity to access the collection. And we welcome anyone over 18, I think.
Right. So you sort of figure out what you want to look at online or however, and then you make an appointment and
go to Watsonline, which is our online catalog. If you look on our digital resources, you'll see things. We also have tons of stuff online. It's not so easy to find on the Met website, but people, you know, can, we have good reference staff and they can help guide people. Mm-hmm. Like if you wanted to know, what do you have in this subject? Or how can I best find these things? I'm not sure I'm searching correctly. People will help you. There are people there to assist.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. And I met you in the mid 1990s when I was the program director at Dudonnet Paper Mill and you were on the board there. Mm-hmm. And I think just before I started working there, they had started a membership program. Mm-hmm. Dudonnet, and part of that membership program was interesting paper activities. And so you, one of the first things I went on with our members was a paper tour through the Met that you put together.
Tell me
a little bit about some of the things we saw. I remember.
My pet peeve is that like no one ever notices the paper, but it is everywhere. It's in every culture and every era and every type of media and art. There is paper. There's so much paper that people never realize or see. I mean, of course, even when they can see it, for example, in drawings, people don't point out or often recognize the contribution that the paper makes to the aesthetic of the artwork. Mm-hmm. So since I had this opportunity to try to inspire, you know, the paper, people who are interested in paper, I started looking at the collection, focusing on the collection that was on permanent display, because the worst thing that can happen is you're going to give a tour and then you take 30 people there and then it's like not there anymore. So I had to, even though we had many other things, I had to kind of focus on what was, I knew was going to be there because I had no control over that. So I looked in every department. It was a wonderful chance for me. So I just went literally to every single department and asked myself, is there paper? Is there paper? And where is it? What form is it? And in Islamic department, of course, you know, and each culture had papers that had such individual qualities and were used for so many, such specific purposes that it was a matter of like figuring out how do I interpret this and how can I speak to it without totally making stuff up? And I had to do a lot of learning. So in Islamic, there were these really early, I don't know if they were 10th century papers or 8th century papers with calligraphy. There were these beautiful polished papers and manuscripts. There was papier-mâché, which became a subject that really intrigued me through this researching this tour, because I kept finding objects that were called papier-mâché in Japanese art, in Islamic art, in European art, and all these papier-mâché objects were different, completely different techniques. And I could see, like, why are they calling all this the same thing? Because they're completely different. And I started learning a lot about what papier-mâché techniques were and how they were different. So I was able to try, in a very basic level, interpret that to others. And I went to Arms and Armor, and there were these a lot of paper and armor, which is amazing. So in the Japanese armor, it was papier-mâché rain hat, traveling hat, which was like mirror, like smooth as glass. Of course, their papier-mâché was done with sheets of paper, laminating sheets, not like mesh. Horse armor was paper mache, and also using paper in the lining of armor for insulation. There was paper filigree in European art, you know, the paper filigree. There was a little tea caddy, and also other things. There was a number of early filigree pieces, I think 18th century, late 18th century. You name it, you know. So the things are the things we saw were and then of course, you know, as an example of how a sheet of paper, I mean, there's a million. I mean, John Creel's book is so fabulous on artist papers. There's a wonderful. I don't know if you've ever read his book, but I think he wrote a book called English Artist Papers, and it's a history of artist papers, and it gave me a lot of insight into all these, like, you know, the evolution of art papers coming from the white papers to the blue sailors, papers made from sailors' clothes, to the French papers that had a, you know, the very smooth, they were treated with the very smooth coating. Mm-hmm. But then I started looking at all the drawings and prints and looking at the Italian papers, especially really meaty, beefy, textured papers, and really just looking to see how the artists use the texture of their paper to make marks, to mm-hmm. contribute to the mark making. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen anything about it or read anything about it. But once you start seeing it, it really popped out. And I really tried to point that out to people because I kind of get to give paper the credit it's due, which it really seems to get. They just say paper. It's like, no, this paper is as important as the paint or the crayon or the pencil that they used. And a perfect example of that is if you look at Seurat drawings, because it's just, it is like his mark making is the texture of the paper. So that's kind of what the tour was about, to like, mm-hmm. to like really make it pop and give the paper makers a little pride in their material, you know, like, hey, it's much more than you even could have imagined, you know, or that anyone has really acknowledged.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about the Paper Advisor, a place where you can discover my most popular papermaking and papercraft resources, including information about tools and supplies, how-to videos, and paper tips, all in one place. You can ask the Paper Advisor your paper questions there too. And best of all, it's free. Find the Paper Advisor by going to HelenHebertStudio.com and looking for the free Paper Advisor link in the upper right-hand corner. Now back to the episode. Let's just briefly talk about some of your favorite places in the Met, because I've come to visit you and go to lunch in the, like, down somewhere. I could never find it on my own. It feels like a maze. Like, it's such a huge building.
You mean on the ground floor?
There's so many
shops.
No, like behind the scenes, even.
Storeroom, like
you mentioned the photo studio. Or the musical
instrument. Oh, that's a great one. So, you know, when you go in the Great Hall and you look up and you see the domes.
Yeah.
So the ceiling is a floor, uh-huh. and that's the floor of the photo studio. So when you go to the photo studio, you're basically walking around those giant domes. Wow. Like there's these three giant domes, and that's kind of a very otherworldly place to go. And very there's no other place in the world like that spot architecturally.
Right. Yeah.
That's a really interesting place to go. And then there's places like Arms and Armor Conservation, where they, you know, they have a collection of medieval armory with all the original tools, which is really interesting to see, and all the stuff they did during World War II, you know, because they were involved in designing helmets for the soldiers.
Right.
And of course, the labs like Asian Art Conservation, that is, you know, only works by daylight, and it has the tatami mats and all the, it's very authentic Japanese made. It's an authentic Japanese conservation studio. You have to take your shoes off when you go there, and you know, that's kind of like, there's worlds, you know, inside the Met that you could travel to, by looking through, like, the period rooms. I know period rooms are kind of out now, but I really like them because I think they do transport you in a way that a regular gallery doesn't. So those, I mean, sometimes you're always the only one in those rooms. Like no one, like if you go up to the American rooms up high,
mm-hmm.
and then you know, and not to mention like all the shops, like on the ground floor of the Met. I mean, the Met is itself independent town. You know, it's got as many people in it as my village does here. It's got 2,000 people, right?
Right.
We don't have 2,000 people. And it has everything it needs to, like, be completely self-sufficient. The world can end and the Met would go on for quite a while. It has carpenters and electricians and plumbers and metalsmiths and roofers and, you know, print shop and all that stuff. So there's a lot of great things to, and the building itself, you get to see the guts of the building, the old tunnel that runs mm-hmm. was the old reservoir tunnel, and all the pipe work. It's just fascinating.
Wow. And I'm just remembering that there was actually, this isn't a shop, like a store, a paper store for a couple years.
Yeah, there was a paper store. You know, they tried a lot of things in retail.
Yeah.
It's changed. Their retail has changed so much. They used to publish a lot of their own things. They don't do that so much anymore. Uh-huh. So yeah, that was one iteration. Right.
Right. Okay, speaking of publishing, let's talk about your publications. So you,
yes,
over the years you've published, you just have specific interests that you've
I make followed. Books. I have always made books, whether it's a one-of-a-kind artist book or a book about, written a book about something that I've, you know, had to get out. So my first book was an autobiography called Guess Who Died? Stories of Memories of Baltimore and with recipes, I think. And it's a cult classic. I still get emails all the time from people saying, like, I found my book and I reread it and I really loved it. I think I still have a few copies. And it was this book of stories about my family, stories that I had always told. And I, you know, my parents died and I thought, all right, I'm going to write these stories down because there aren't going to be any more and I'm going to forget them, you know? So, and in a way they died too young. So I wasn't finished. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I needed to use the book, which a book can do, conjure them back up again. I needed to bring them back. Mm-hmm. I wasn't finished with them. So I thought somehow through making a book, writing the stories, making a book, putting my pictures in, that it would somehow bring them back and they can have new friends, which wound up to be true. You know, now all these people knew my parents that never knew them in their life that really got a kick out of them. So it was my homage, you know, to my parents. And it was my way of using the book as a way to heal from grief, which it is, you know, there's nothing like books for a lot of things. And that's one of the things about books is it can help you. Not just the writing, but the process of making it and creating it and working with others about it and talking with others about it. And I had Mimi Scher help me with that one, like, greatly. And
it kind of looks like a recipe book. It's a spiral bound.
I wanted to make it like a recipe book. It has
it has great stories.
High quality paper. I just made my grandma's soup out of it last night. You know, after I made the book, I could forget everything because I know it's in the book. And so I just go use it all the time. The stories have, the recipes relate to the stories and the recipes are like illustrations, you know, to me, because they're like, they were so much part of life. So that was my first book. And then I spent 15 years on Alice Morse. Alice Morse was an amazing Met story because Alice Morse went to the Met in the 1920s and gave her collection of, she was one of the first American book cover designers, and she worked for all the big publishers in New York. And she started working in the late 1880s and retired when she was 65. It turns out, I found all this out after years of research, of course, came to the Met, made a gift of her covers. They had an exhibition of them in the library, and then they gave them, put them away, and they were never cataloged and no one ever knew they were there. So 70 years later, I found them.
How did you stumble across them?
Snooping around, opening boxes. What's this? What's that? You know, they were in a box that said like book covers. And I was like, huh, that, you know, so they were in drawings and prints because I was doing my survey. I do a survey there every year, collection survey. And I saw that box and I was like, what's this? And I went, oh my God, who is this person? Didn't really have anything about her much, and said that she wasn't so important, that she didn't do much. And inside those that box was 58 of her covers. So I was like, well, she made 58 covers. So that led me, and this of course was really started before the internet. So I had to associate, I had to find all the books because I had to make sure that the covers were actually real and used, and that the way they were published matched the way the covers that were hers. These were her exhibition covers because in the 19th century, applied arts, which book cover design was one, were exhibited like any other kind of art. I mean, weren't separated out and specialized like they are now. So these were her show covers. You know, they had never really been on books. And some of them were kind of unfinished, even like publishers to her, you know, like when they made them. So there were shows every year of book covers. The Architectural League and Grolier Club had shows in the 1890s. There were other places. So I was determined to give her credit, which is a common theme in my projects, is like, I feel like somebody didn't get the appreciation they deserved. And so I spent 15 years trying to give it to them. And because I did it with Alfred Launder too, although I never published a book about him, but I published his book. He was the Met's first binder. That was before Alice Morse. He's interesting. And so her, so I had a big exhibition at the Grolier Club and I published my findings. which was the first descriptive bibliography of book covers really ever written, because no one had ever done that. They always leave out the book covers in descriptive bibliography. So I wrote her biography, and it's kind of a catalog resume, you know, although I have my blog, when I find new things, I add it there.
Right. And we'll put a link to your blog.
Yeah. I got up to about 200 covers for her, 200 tech titles. And so that, I had my exhibition, and then I wrote a book about something I'd started even before then, Books, The Art of Books That Aren't, which is my collection of book-shaped objects, which is still growing.
Yeah.
And I wrote really the first book on the history of book-shaped objects. So two books came out this year. That was 2016 in Germany. I mean, they're not American, but it's happening. So
you mean on book-shaped objects, similar?
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a subject that was everywhere in front of everyone's face and no one ever seemed to notice it. And I think a couple of reasons, the kitsch factor, and which of course nobody from Baltimore would ever shy away from. And also, yeah, I don't know why, because it's a parallel history to book history.
Right.
The history of book-shaped objects is a parallel history. And there's so many ways in which it comes together. And then, and I've gotten a lot of interest on individual subjects. So like people have asked me, could they publish pictures of things in my collection for books on the history of daguerreotype cases or the history of, you know, material culture of kitchens or, you know, all kinds of things. So it's getting integrated now. I'm really happy about that.
And is that on your blog too? The blog?
Oh yeah. I have tons of copies of those and my Alice Morse book. So you can order any of these books through my blog or through contacting me, but I linked it to PayPal and I just got an order yesterday for my Books book. So I know it works.
But you have written about specific books on Books on your blog, right?
Oh yeah.
You have entries.
Not lately, but there's tons of stuff on there.
Yeah. Tell me about one of your favorite Book discoveries.
Well, there's so many amazing ones, but I guess one of the most amazing ones is that I found this wooden book that looks like an 18th century quarto. It doesn't have a title on it, but it has all the attributes of an authentic book where it's painted. It's a painted book with brown, with like, looks like it has, you know, speckling, and it's got red edges and it has clasp and it's big. And it opens up into a Catholic portable altar. And it's very intriguing to me. I took it up to the curators in European Sculpture and Decorative Arts to see what they thought about it. And they thought it was very unusual and that it was 18th century and that it was, you know, it's like, you know, and I did read a little bit about portable altars like that being used on ships and are just being taken. But I think because it doesn't look like a Bible. There's nothing about it that says Bible. It's very generic. So we were thinking maybe it was like a hidden Catholic altar where it wasn't, you know, legal to be Catholic. And someone might have had in more of a closeted situation where it could have just been disappeared on the bookshelf, you know. So it's a mystery object and it's a very unusual object and old and interesting. And so that's a good one. But, you know, there's a lot of stories like that. I have a lot of very moving objects. You know, I like the funny ones. I like the ingenious ones, the contraptions. But I also, and I love the ones that really relate specifically to book history and to real books that existed, you know, that are sort of very closely related to book history. But I do have my first one and my favorite one, you know, which is a book made out of anthracite coal.
What does your collection look like physically? I know you've exhibited it, but how big is it?
I have over 700 objects, and some of them are very tiny, like teeny tiny, you know, like just like books. They're miniature or they're quartos. I don't have a folio, I don't think, but I have a bunch of quartos. Like I have a book backpack, and that's pretty big. And I have an amazing, do you know national cash registers? You remember cash registers, right? Yeah. So I have a very early national shop accounting system in the form of a very giant, it's a big oak box carved made to look like a big fat account book. Oh. And it was a patented object. So the patented one's also fascinating. Yeah. And it's fun to look for the patents and see like what was the original intention and what did they originally look like, or is mine the same? Like cameras, there's a lot of patented book cameras. There's hundreds of patents.
Right.
For book-shaped objects. So there's the ones that were patented and mass produced supposedly, and then there are unique, very unique personal ones that were handmade, one of a kind, often love gifts or prisoner art or you know, mourning objects, or it's a rich, rich subject without an end. And it's been very wonderful to have that as a hobby.
Oh yeah.
Over my life. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll point people to the blog to read more, because I want to move on and talk about the Paper Legacy Project.
Oh, yes. Okay. So, right. That's another big effort on my part, multi-year effort, in the sense that I'm old, right? And I just think I'm not going to go on forever. And, you know, who knows how long I'm going to be at the Met. And I was also very sad when 4 years ago, my partner, John, died, the first member of the Center for Book Arts. And I was like, oh my God, I need to focus on something big. This is like, especially when he died, not so much now, I just could see the end of my life, you know? And I just was like, of course it is there, but, you know, I thought like, okay, so now what? Like, I can't just stop. I've got to do something. I've got to use my clout from the success of the Blooks exhibition, which was huge. God, I was in the New York Times. I was on CBS Sunday Morning. If you really want to see my Blooks collection, look for the CBS Sunday Morning, you know, interview.
We'll link to that. Yeah.
I think it's called Fake Books or something. And it's a tour of my show.
Right.
But anyway, I thought I got one more in me, definitely. And I want to make a big contribution to the book and paper arts. And I want to do something wonderful for the Watson Library that I don't think anybody else could do, because I have a quirky way of like living and being, thinking about things. And I just thought, I know I can do something really wonderful, you know, as a finale project. Who knows if it really will be my finale, but that's how I felt at the time. And so I thought about all the aspects of the book and paper arts, and which ones were well represented historically in research collections and which ones could maybe fall off the face of the earth, you know? And I felt that decorative paper, first of all, I lived through an incredible period in the revitalization of decorative paper in America that was very active from the 70s through the 90s and has changed since then. But that was a moment where for the first time, American artists made commercial decorative papers. It was available everywhere for everyone. And it was really out there totally on sheets and Kleenex boxes and in papers themselves on rare books. And it was just like a moment. And I felt that all these artists now, a lot of them are in their 70s and 80s. And I just thought like they never had a professional organization, you know, and I thought they're going to fall off the face of the earth. Like no one's going to know what they did and how amazing it was. So I got permission from my boss to go for it. And, you know, I made a list of the ones I knew. I was originally going to just do 12. Well, I have 50. So I have no control, obviously. And,
talk a little bit about the artists, the range. So you have marblers,
ones were marblers. So there's oil marblers in the beginning before everybody realized how toxic the oil marbling was. So Paul Maurer, amazing guy called Richard Longstreet, Cove, a lot of people you might never have heard about because they weren't necessarily that commercial, but they had a lot of influence on other people in the late 60s and early 70s. And then there were the marblers like Diane Maurer, Iris Nevins, Faith Harrison, who's the designer of the paper for that Kleenex box that was sold in stores for over 20 years. And Susan Pagoni, who did a lot of work for Hallmark. Then a lot of the paste paper artists would be Sage Reynolds and Claire Mazarchik. And there's a lot. So I built the collection. It's done for now. And it's pretty comprehensive. And it includes people coming into the field from the 60s through the 90s. That were commercial. That was what I was focusing on. And there are a couple maybe three hand paper makers, and they were included only because in their lines of paper, which they sold, they regularly made papers that were decorative papers in the sense of the kinds of papers that were being sold to be used for other things. So like cave paper, Andrea Peterson.
Tom Leach.
So Tom Leach is a marbler, really, but he liked to marble his own handmade paper. Right. And he developed this particular technique that was called integrative marbling, which he needed the handmade paper for. It was part of his aesthetic. So most of these artists just used commercial machine-made papers. Right. Many of them also used high-end art papers like Arche.
Right.
Some cared about acidity and others didn't. Marbling is a very acidic process anyway. Mm-hmm. Whereas other artists like Claire Mazarchik really focused on alkaline papers and durability and consistency and non-fading aspects. The marblers weren't as concerned about that. So anyway, I thought, I'll make this. So I asked all the artists to please send a representative collection of your papers. I left that to them. Describe those papers fully. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean by that? Everything. The date, yeah. Who made for, how it was made, what are the materials. And fill out this questionnaire was basically every question I could think of that I would have for these artists, you know, at the time that I started, you know. So, of course, they all did their own thing and did something different because no two people listen to you the same way or, you know, so, or they just do what they want to do, their artists. So, collections all rolled in. And I said, all right. And the information rolled in. And they also sent supplemental material, amazing material, correspondence and exhibition catalogs and, all kinds of ephemera and things like shoes, marbling aprons and tools. I have a great tool collection. So I said to my boss, it's here now. It's here. We've saved this generation. Everyone who wants to know how to make these papers, artists can come and see, this paper is amazing. How did they make it? They're going to know how they made it. And they're going to hear from the artists about their, whatever they wanted to say about their career. I didn't nudge them too much because I just thought, well, it's their, I want the whole thing about this collection is that it's first hand, you know, it's from the artist, not me interpreting what the artists are thinking. And I said, if somebody ever wants to write a book, they got everything they need right here. So yay. But then I said, well, maybe we should have an exhibition at the Girl Ear Club because everyone's still alive. They can like get the glory. We can see all the papers together. Has anybody ever seen these papers together? Probably not. No. And let's go for it. So he was supportive and that's what I did. So this exhibition, this is what I'm working on now and why I can work from home is because I'm writing the exhibition catalog, which includes a narrative, chronological narrative of the evolution of this period, you know, as best as I can interpret it. And it has a full directory of all the artists with all their factual information and very brief bios, among other things. So, so I'm trying to nail, you know, get all that information in one place and, tell some stories and give people a sense of what it was like when you can march yourself down to New York Central Supply and just see all these papers there and flip through all those, you know, that display rack and say, you know, and just, it was all there and all was available to everyone. And it was a magical, magical opportunity and moment in book in paper history.
And this collection will be, people will be able to study it.
Yes, they can study it. We've digitized the papers.
Okay.
And they're on our digital, not all of them have been, we couldn't finish before COVID, but you know, they're low res because some of the artists were worried about getting their images stolen, their copyright, but it's there. And there's a lot more in the collection that is online.
And then when is I know we're still in, under COVID right now, but when is the exhibition?
It's going to be January through April, like mid-January through mid-April 2023. Yeah.
And you'll publish this exhibition catalog to coincide.
Book? Hey, it's been paid for. It's going to happen. I'm almost, you know, I'm really well into writing it and starting to select the illustrations. And I have a designer who I intentionally picked because I thought he had an affinity for this subject and experience in working with book artists. And I'm hoping that he really gets all of the aspects of even the intangibles of how, why it's so wonderful. And that'll come through with it. I really wanted this, my book to be, because, you know, even though I work in a library and I see thousands of art books every year, a lot of them don't really appeal to me in terms of really being immersive and like I can't put them down. Mm-hmm. And I want my book to be that way. So I was thinking I wanted to be lyrical. I wanted to have the qualities that the papers have, which are translucency and just the beauty and the movement of these papers. And I just hope that it can happen, that everyone's going to love it and like want to hold it, you know? We'll see.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, because I've just reviewed the manuscript, the first version of my next book, which is a how-to book about all these things you can make with one sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. And I don't have anything to do with the design process. I can say, you know, I can say whatever I want, but it's hard to make that, to have that conversation, mm-hmm. even with yourself, about what you want it to look like and how.
Well, this is what I noticed about the book designs. Mm-hmm. Either they were really dry and it was like text illustration. Right. Well, there's a barrier there. You can't really like, it doesn't speak to your heart. Mm-hmm. Or if the designer was really great and they did an amazing design, often that design was more about the designer than it was about the subject. Mm-hmm. And there was a disconnect between the subject and the designer. And so I was really looking for a designer, you know, that I felt like that's what they're about, the same qualities that the paper is about. And so that's, I'm hoping to achieve it through that. And it was hard. It was hard.
Yeah.
And of course, it's totally subjective. It's like, this is, I'm making it all up. I mean, this is what I think at the moment, you know, so.
Yeah, it really
it
is.
It turns out that he had studied bookbinding with Tim Ely. So.
Uh-huh. Right. Right. And I had an interesting story with the cover of my next book where the designer, you know, I just didn't feel like it was holding together. And then so I asked some questions and found out that she had actually looked at the work of this other paper artist. And in the meantime, I had said, maybe a paper artist should design this, like someone who illustrates with paper, not just the graphic designer at the company. And mm-hmm. so anyway, she was inspired by this paper artist who happens to design book covers. So potentially he's going to design the cover for my book. We're still, I don't know.
Oh,
yet.
Good. Yeah. It's important because the effort that goes in to making a book, nobody knows that more than you.
Oh, yeah.
You can't stop at writing it. It has to come through in the physical experience that we have with the object. This is what my book collection is about. It's about what is that happens? What is that relationship between the human and the object of the book? And how is that so unique to anything else? And how do I articulate that? And how do I thank it for my entire life, which I love, and from that perspective? And I thought, well, if I remove the text from the book and you just show the object in the sense that like the decisions people have made to interpret the book, how they've been, what they've chosen about books to include in these objects that are representing the book, that it would tell me something about that relationship.
Right.
And that's the same kind of relationship that I'm trying to establish, you know, in picking a designer for my book, is that the feeling, the relationship, the magical thing that happens when you're, that book is yours and you're in it, you know, you're not just dying to close it and throw it on the shelf. You're not pissed off at it because it doesn't open flat. You're not, you know, so it has to do with like the feeling, the giving aspect of the object, the way in which the structure works and the paper works. It has to do with the aesthetic relationship of all the things that were choices that were made, just as we made all these decisions when we wrote our books, you know? Right. So it's not a haphazard thing, and it's a hard thing to achieve. And it's not, and also I don't really think the industry seems to want it, because I talked to a lot of designers and they all said to me, we love what you want to do, but like nobody wants it. And I would be like, well, all right, well, I want it.
Right. It's all about what's going to sell. Yeah. Right.
So it's apples and oranges, you know? Right. I mean, I'm only making 1,000 copies of this book, so it's not like there's going to be millions of copies around.
Right. Right. No. Yeah. Okay. We need to wind down with, I want to hear about your recommendations. So let's start with the Teflon bone folder. You make your own?
Yeah. So I buy every kind there is, and I make other kinds, for instance, especially small ones, because you can't buy a lot of little teeny ones, and you can't buy ones that have shapes. So I have certain shapes that I'm looking for certain tasks that I'm using it for. But the bottom line for paper people is that if you use a regular bone folder, it's going to burnish your paper and make it shiny and make it look unattractive. Right. So you need to use a Teflon folder if you're folding or doing anything with paper. So my tip was simply that you can buy bar Teflon from a plastic store online, and in like foot long pieces and different thicknesses. And if you can carve it and sand it into any shape that you want. And that's been very useful for me for book binding. Yeah. Because I've made a shape that had like an inverted curve that I could run along a round spine. And I've made ones that have like a totally flat bottom with a very slightly like a fingernail substitute that I can like slide into things and split things. Uh-huh. And I've made ones that have very fine little tips that can tuck things into tiny little places. So my tip for that was that you have to get it hot to cut it because it's rigid. I mean, I got it, you know, I stuck it in the microwave, or I put it in boiling water. I cut it to the width I want. And then I just would use like an Alpha knife or something to carve it, because you're not breathing that stuff, which you don't want to breathe.
Right.
And to carve it into the general shape that I want. Once I get the general shape as finely tuned as I can, I sanded it with that like emery wet dry sanding paper in a bucket of water. Like I sanded it in water because I didn't want it in the air to breathe it.
Right.
And you know, it was fast. It didn't take long to make them. So that's a good tip. And the other tip that I had was the scrapbooking tips.
Yeah.
Because I found that, you know, all bookbinders have always used tools which they pinched from other professions, because, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't have that are mass produced. So, you know, scrapbooking can be very annoying, but to bookbinders, especially, you know, professional bookbinders, but boy, they sure have put a lot of money into development of tools. Mm-hmm. And the tools that I've found useful most are, like, first of all, there's a new a magnetic cutting mat. So if you use it with a metal ruler, it holds the ruler down. When you're dealing with those little tiny finicky things, like if you're trying to cut Mylar in your case, or if you're a paper maker, you're often cutting those stencils with little tiny things, it holds it in place.
Cool.
It makes it easier to cut out little annoying things, especially if they're slippery. So that's a good tool. And there's also lots of great handheld corner rounders. I think Crocodile's a company that makes some of those. And they're pretty strong. The Crocodile's pretty strong. And of course, if you use it for Mylar or something, it's going to wear out really fast. But for paper, it's good. And it'll go through board too, that one. It's got a lot of like leverage on it. So I think those are useful tools. And then the third one I think I mentioned was the use of buying ashtrays, which have a bad rep because ashtrays people think is smoking and dirt.
Yeah.
Boy, ashtrays are like the best little dish for adhesive because A, they're free, nobody wants them, or they're cheap.
Right.
And if you're not using a lot of glue, you don't waste a lot of glue. It's nice and shallow. And because of the dips for the cigarettes or cigars, it holds your brush. And how many times has your brush rolled off your dish onto the floor and it's like got glue everywhere?
Yeah.
So it solves that problem.
Perfect.
But if you want to be more elegant, you can also use a lot of Japanese dishes. Dishes have those qualities. Dishes have those qualities, like a serrated edge or like a flower type petal edge that, you know, holds the brush.
Yeah.
Right. So all those things work, but ashtrays are cheapest, and they made me laugh. I like the idea of using them for that. So that's, and then for classes, you know, it's great because there's brushes everywhere, right? You don't can roll onto somebody else's work. That would be a disaster. So,
that's for a great tip.
Yeah, it's a good tip. Those are tool tips.
Cool. And you gave me a bunch of links, but let's just mention the link to your blog online. I'll put these all on the show notes page.
You know, one of the things I've done over the years is had a lot of symposium on book related subjects at the Met. And one was on Japanese illustrated books. And the second day of that, there's two videos. The second video has amazing techniques on how they made some of this historic work on Japanese textured papers. And that would be interesting for people to see. And then I did one on artist books. And And so, you know, you can watch it. And then Yukari did some, which I put links to, on how to do orizome and, you know, different paper techniques.
Yeah, I'll put all those links as well as the links to your blogs. You have a couple of blogs.
Yes, and people, if they have questions or whatever, they should just email me at my name, MindelDubansky@gmail.com. And I'm happy to, you know, talk to people about any of this. Always.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Mindy, for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Helen. I really, of course, enjoyed it. You're a wonderful interviewer. I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks a lot.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.